You told me I'd be okay there. I thought with the cop posted, we figured that if the guy wanted to hurt you the first time, he could have. Curtis thought he was just trying to scare you. I agreed. Well, I don't think the cop who was lying there dead on the side of the house would agree with that analysis. Probably not. So you're not going to tell me where you are? Jasmine hesitated. I think it's best no one knows. Besides, I'll be moving around, just in case. You need me to pick up some stuff from your house? Clothes? That'd be great. I figured I'd just have to go shopping. I've got a suitcase in the hall closet. I take it you heard the news, Vale said, as she navigated a turn on the dark street and accelerated. About my father? Once I saw that deputy lying there, I knew. That's why I'm not telling anyone where I am. And now that my father knows I'm not at my house, he won't be going back there. I'm still going to stay away, though. Who knows if he's got someone keeping an eye out for me? Why do you think he knows you're not there? Because he's smart, and because he knows me, and because he probably saw me drive away, or he searched the house and knew I'd left. It's the only logical conclusion. Cops have an officer stationed there to protect me, so I'm going to be there, right? He kills the cop and searches the house, but I'm not there. Obviously, I left when I realized something was wrong. Thank God for that neighbor. If she hadn't found the body and screamed, I probably would have ended up like that cop. No one knows that better than me. I don't know what more I could have done, but I'm sorry you had to go through that, and I'm relieved you got away. What's being done to find him? Don't worry about that. We're working on it. Actually, a whole task force is working on it. Law enforcement is deployed all across the state. She glanced in her mirror. No headlights. No one's following me. Jesus, Karen, why would anyone be following you? This whole business with Marks and the task force and Jasmine's paranoia, although well-deserved, had spooked her. Not an easy thing to do. Let's meet tomorrow. I need to go through some things with you about your dad, things that may help us find him, and I'll go by your place on the way, okay? A quick breakfast? My treat? Only if you make sure you're not followed. Can you do that? I've got some experience with that, yeah. Text me the time and location, and I'll be there. Chapter 14. The Virginia winter was proving more brutal than Roscoe Lee Marks had remembered. The sweaters and knit shirts that he had pilfered from a house owned by the Jensen family, somewhere along the way between Strasburg and Cub Run, had reached the limits of their insulating capacity. The bottle of foundation he found in the wife's bathroom drawer helped cover some of the bruising on his face, while the car he had taken from the Jensen's garage, though nothing special, was proving useful. He had parked it a mile down the road in an area not visible from the street to prevent the cops from finding it, and proceeded on foot in search of shelter. He had to stay hydrated and fed and avoid the extreme overnight cold. The flashlight he borrowed from the Jensen's kitchen, however, was not as serviceable. It was the type that used an old incandescent bulb, which produced a pathetically dim beam that had diminished significantly in the past 15 minutes. Its yellow hue covered only a few feet in front of him. However, at some point this afternoon, he lost the cell phone Sue Alafanti had bought him. He had made the calls he needed to, so it was not a tragedy, but having it would have made life easier. Where it was, he had no idea. It could be somewhere along the side of a rural road or buried in a snowdrift where he had stopped to take a piss. He knew that in the hands of law enforcement, if they figured out it was his, it would provide them with some insight as to who he had contacted and how to apprehend him. He hoped it would remain where he had left it, untouched. But of course, he could not take a chance. He had to alter his approach. It was merely another obstacle he would have to overcome. Hell, he had escaped a maximum security facility. Whatever lay ahead might be considered infinitely easier. He now trudged along in a rustic, forested area that was dotted with occasional homes. Some 2 dozen yards in the distance, illuminated slightly by the faint moonlight that made its way through the barren tree branches, was a clapboard house and, more importantly, what looked like a large detached shed. A bedroom, with a mattress, running water, and toilet, was unquestionably better, and he had no compunction about doing what was necessary to the home's inhabitants, but the fewer breadcrumbs he left in his wake, the better. He could hide in the shed, get some sleep, and map out a plan of action in the morning. The problem he had now, how to find Jasmine, was at the crux of all he had to solve. Everything else was a matter of survival, though he had to stop and take a deep breath of chilled air from time to time, smell the flowers, enjoy his freedom for as long as it lasted. If he was careful, and a little bit lucky, he would have the luxury of taking his time working his way to Canada or Mexico. He would have to think on that. He had originally figured he would go south to get out of the cold, but that was perhaps too obvious. He had to start thinking with a contrarian point of view, do the opposite of what he should or would do. After what he had done, especially after what he had done, the authorities would be looking for him en masse. Like death and taxes, that much was a given. As he approached the shed, he could see it was more like a small barn, and the main house was larger than he had thought. He broke the rusted lock and pulled open the wooden door, only enough to slide his body inside. He winced at the creak of the hinge as he drew it closed behind him. There was equipment of all kinds, from what he could tell. Although there was a light switch on the wall where he had entered, he would not dare turn it on. The homeowner was a handy guy, it seemed. He had an extensive assortment of tools, mounted neatly on pegboards with workbenches, drill presses, ladders, and a variety of power saws. Marks gathered up an old tarpaulin, scattered straw, and rags he had found in a lawn bag by the door. As he assembled his bed, the cold now penetrating down to the bone, he tried to think of a way to get close to Jasmine. First, he had to find her. He was sure she would not go back to her house. He knew she had left her old job, but where did she work now? He had no idea. That presented a problem. Just as he began to feel like he was looking for a needle in a haystack, appropriate given where he was, he hit on an idea. Yes! He thought, that'll definitely work. Chapter 15. Vale arrived home 30 minutes late. After hanging up with Jasmine, she called Robbie and apologized, then told him she was en route. He took it in stride and was not surprised. She ran into the house looking frazzled, as if she had just come from a crime scene, which was not far from the truth. "I'm so sorry," she said. Aside from Jonathan and Robbie, DEA Special Agent Richard Prati and his son Ryan were seated in the family room. She stepped around the ottoman and stretched to shake their hands when Hershey pushed his way in to greet her. They all laughed as she cuddled his head in her left palm while extending her right toward Prati. "Good to see you again, Karen. Working a case?" "You heard about the escape of Roscoe Lee Marks?"
"It's all over the news," Prati said.
"That's mine. Working on a Marshall's fugitive task force." She turned to the 19-year-old. "Ryan, good to meet you."
"Same here, Agent Vale."
"Karen, please." She leaned left and gave Jonathan a kiss on the cheek. "How are you, sweetie?"
"Good. Just found out Ryan's a beta."
Vale straightened up. "You pledged beta, too? What school are you at?"
"University of Florida. I'm in for a quick visit to see my parents, then it's back at it."
"I'm going to check on dinner," Robbie said. "Let's go take a seat at the table." As they gathered up their drinks and walked into the dining room, which was meticulously set, "Thank you, Robbie," Vale asked. "What's your major?" Prati laughed.
"Ryan has some pretty career-specific plans."
"Following in your dad's footsteps?"
"In a way. I'm going to join the Navy, see if I can hook on with the SEALs.
That's a pretty demanding program. I know some former Special Forces guys if you want to talk to them. I'm sure I can get one or two to sit down with you.
That'd be cool. Prati placed a hand on his son's shoulder. Ryan's already a certified advanced scuba diver, lettered in track, swimming, cross-country, wrestling, and lacrosse.
You're kidding, Vale said. Robbie poked his head out of the kitchen.
Actually, he's not kidding. That's one impressive young man.
No shit?
He's also a licensed skydiver.
Dad, Ryan said, they get the picture.
I have the utmost respect for Special Forces, Vale said. Robbie stepped in carrying a steaming tureen and gave her a look.
Okay, fine. I better shut up. I'm not supposed to talk about that stuff.
Jonathan's taking fencing, she said, changing the subject.
Really? Jonathan asked mockingly. I'm taking a class in fencing? That's supposed to be impressive?
Hey, Robbie said. Don't sell yourself short, he elbowed Ryan. Jonathan's very good.
It's something I've wanted to learn, Ryan said. You like it?
You need a lot of lower body and core strength. Obviously, that wouldn't be a problem for you. And like any sport, you've really got to practice a lot to be good. Things happen very fast, so you're reacting instinctively rather than thinking. The more you do it, the better prepared you are to respond. If you've got to take a split second to think, you're done. Ryan was nodding. Definitely would like to get into that.
And how are things with DEA?
Vale asked as she took the casserole from Robbie and set it in the center of the table.
Never a dull moment, Prati said. I'm sure Robbie can attest to that.
No kidding. Law enforcement's a tough career for a family. She picked up the bottle of wine and began refilling Prati's and Robbie's glasses, then poured one for herself.
Between his work with DEA and mine with the Bureau, we have to work to make time for each other.
And I can attest to that, Jonathan said. Like today. Vale blushed.
Sorry, sweetie. Not how I envisioned it going, but I really had no choice.
She turned to Prati. I was giving a talk to one of Jonathan's criminal justice classes when all hell broke loose. Marks escaped. A police officer who was guarding his daughter was murdered, and both calls came through at the same time, about a minute or two into my talk. She placed a hand on Jonathan's.
We'll get it rescheduled, I promise.
He grinned slyly. It was kind of cool, actually.
Cool?
Robbie asked, as he set bowls of broccolini, sautéed spinach, and kale beet salad on the table. Everyone could kind of figure out there was something serious going down. It was a bit dramatic, especially when she dropped the F-bomb in front of the class. Robbie covered his eyes and shook his head.
It sounds worse than it was, Vale said, giving Jonathan a disapproving glance.
Everybody eat up. She started passing around the dishes and unfurled her napkin.
Robbie tells me you guys went to the same college in L.A.
Prati swirled his wine glass. When he called me to help you out on that domestic bombing case a couple of months ago, I Googled him just to see who I was dealing with. I realized we both went to UCLA a few years apart, but we had some of the same classes and instructors.
From there you went into the DEA?
My degree was in chemical engineering. Then I did an internship with Dow and realized I didn't want a career in corporate or research work, too boring for my taste. But someone at Dow mentioned there was a need for chemists in law enforcement. Prati set a spoonful of broccolini on his plate. Started out with Florida Department of Law Enforcement, then hooked on with ATF.
ATF, Val said. Impressive. What's the higher rate? 5% of applicants?
I think it's even lower.
No question, I was fortunate. The 6 years I spent with them was an important 6 years.
learned a hell of a lot about arson, explosives, firearms trafficking, and the criminal elements that play in those sandboxes. The most eye-opening experience was the training I got at the Fire Research Lab in Beltsville.
What's a fire research lab? Jonathan asked.
Prati chuckled.
A place where people go to play with fire. Seriously, it's a huge facility dedicated to the study of fire. Fire scientists use every imaginable piece of high-tech instrumentation to measure heat release rate, burn rate, something called heat flux, and a bunch of other things important in forensic reconstruction of fire-related crimes. Only one like it in the world. They even construct actual buildings and recreate an arson scene that they videotape to demonstrate burn patterns for investigation and court testimony.
I'd love to check that out, Robbie said. I can probably get you a tour, just stay away from the dead pigs.
Is that a joke? Fail asked.
Prati laughed. Pigs have the same makeup of skin, fat content, and body mass as we do, so the scientists use them to simulate the burning of a human body. Those studies helped me break the last case I worked for ATF, a string of arsons that ultimately turned out to be crime concealment fires.
We've got one of those right now at the BAU, Fail said.
They can be tough, especially if the arsonist is good.
Still, getting info on the other crime scenes, but it definitely looks serial.
Can you pass the chicken? Robbie asked.
Which case is this?
Vale lifted the serving dish to her left and handed it to him.
Not one of mine. It's Art Rooney's. But we've got those Wednesday presentations where we put our heads together, help each other out.
I'll have some of that, too, Jonathan said, receiving the platter from Robbie.
I assume a crime concealment fire is what it sounds like?
Pretty much, Prati said. Killer sets fires to cover his tracks. It's a way to destroy any evidence they inadvertently left behind, like if they touched things without realizing it. This way they get rid of everything and don't have to worry about it.
But they have to know a fire like that will attract attention, Ryan said. Obviously, the fire department's going to be all over it.
And the police, Prati said, if not the ATF. But they're figuring that whatever evidence they've left behind linking them to the crime will be destroyed.
And if they've killed someone, Vale said, they're hoping they've completely removed the ability for investigators to determine that it's even a homicide. No body. You can't even be sure the person in question was home at the time.
Prati finished chewing and pointed his fork at Vale.
Yeah, but arson investigators are really sharp. They find all kinds of stuff the offender has no idea these guys can find. They can usually tell it's an arson.
Art had a case where the body was pretty well gone, but not completely consumed. They were able to tell that the cause of death wasn't the fire, but some other kind of traumatic injury, she turned to Ryan.
Unless the offender's an insider, they don't know all the things we can do, like the guy who kidnapped and killed that family in D.C. While waiting for the ransom payment, he ordered pizza. We got DNA off the crust in the garbage, ID'd him, and nabbed his ass.
Vale stuck her fork into another chunk of chicken.
Everything's really good, honey. Thanks again for taking care of dinner.
Yes, Prati said. Everything's perfect. I appreciate you asking us over.
I'm glad we got to meet Ryan, Robbie said.
How's GW? Prati asked.
Jonathan wiped his mouth with a napkin.
I'm really enjoying...
Vale's phone vibrated noticeably, crawling along the table. Her eyes drifted over to Robbie's. He shook his head subtly, telling her not to look. But she had to. She was now working a case that was time-sensitive. She had been warned about not missing a text. Except that it wasn't a text. It was a phone call.
Excuse me, she said. I've got to take this.
No worries, Prati laughed. Just goes to what we were saying before, and hey, any questions about fire, I'm happy to help.
She thanked him, apologizing again as she gathered up the Samsung and walked into the family room. It was Hurdle.
I thought you said to be back at 10.
Something's come up. Wasn't the protocol a group text message?
This is only for you and Curtis. Don't bother going back to the command post. You were right. There's a new Vic. Tarkov's texting you the address.
In times like these, I hate it when I'm right.
Chapter 16. It was a county road a few miles off George Washington Memorial Parkway, pitch black in all directions except for the rhythmic pulse of the law enforcement vehicles, candy-colored lights, and their focused high beams, which bored directly ahead into the stand of pines. Vale pulled behind the line of cars as snow flurries began to fall, twinkling in her headlights like wayward lightning bugs zipping this way and that. She got out and blinked away the snowflakes that stuck to her eyelids, then came up alongside Hurdle, who was standing at the perimeter puffing on a cigarette.
"Curtis'll be here any minute," he said, not bothering to turn and look at her. He blew smoke out the side of his mouth, away from Vale. "How'd you know he was going to kill again so fast?"
"He'd been in the slammer for 7 years. Most incarcerated offenders are able to turn off the instinct, the hunger. They don't have any choice, really. Marx appeared to be one of them. But as soon as he was free, he was like a kid in a toy store. So many potential victims. All he had to do was choose one he wanted and strike. This has been building inside for years."
"Like pulling a cork out of a champagne bottle."
"What was wrong with my kid in a toy store simile?"
"Like mine better."
Two headlights threw their shadows against the black tree trunks of the tall pines. Vale turned and saw Curtis get out of his car.
"Haven't even had time to digest my dinner," Curtis said as he made his way toward them.
"Victim could have probably said the same thing."
"Let's go do this."
Hurdle dropped the butt to the ground and squished it with his shoe into the wet asphalt. They slipped booties on and ducked beneath the crime scene tape, where a patrol officer, with a flashlight, directed them to another cop, who was standing below ground level, in a slight clearing next to a body. Lindy Dyson was there, her kit splayed open and a few portable lights standing on tripods surrounding the corpse.
"Do we know who she is?"
Without a word, Dyson handed back a Virginia driver's license. Vale took it and used her phone light to read it. "Tammy Hartwell, 34, corrective lenses." Vale looked up and scanned the body.
"She's not wearing any glasses."
"Contacts," Curtis said. "Or maybe she wasn't driving when the perp came upon her."
"Or maybe they fell off in a struggle."
Behind them was Leslie Johnson. "Got here as soon as I could."
"We had a theory on M.O., Curtis said. "He entraps them when they're driving, uses a ruse to get them out of the car, then gets close enough to easily and quietly disable them. Maybe he makes believe his car is having problems. They stop and come over to help him, and that's when he anesthetizes them. He takes them somewhere and tortures them, brings them to a secluded area, usually a park or a wooded area, and dumps the body."
"Well, that seems to fit," Hurdle said.
"Doesn't pose them," Val said. "At least not overtly. He leaves them face up, probably so we see the bloody lines. Abdomen's laid bare, as we discussed. Those lines mean something to him. He wants us to see them."
"Well, he succeeded," Hurdle said. "We see him."
Curtis licked a few flakes of snow off his lips.
"And the excised genitalia. Don't know about you, but that's just friggin' gross."
Vale turned to him. "Did you think we'd find that anything but gross?"
"How long's she been out here?" Johnson asked.
Dyson checked her watch.
"I did a liver poke, I'd say about 4 hours. Lucked out that a hiker found her before some animal realized he hadn't gotten enough to eat today."
"Cause of death?"
"Severed carotid," Dyson said.
Curtis looked up into the falling flurries.
"Like the others."
"Like the others."
Vale considered that, except that this was not exactly like the other murders.
"Problem?" Curtis asked.
Nah, just giving it some thought. It's like the other M.O.'s, and yet it's different. He usually spent time with the body before dumping it, but he didn't do that here. He's not been out long enough to enjoy his time with the victim. Why would he spend so much less time with this woman? Hurdle crouched to get a better look at the body.
What you said earlier. Maybe he was so excited to be free, to be able to kill again, that he couldn't contain himself. He was so eager to kill that he had to do it. He couldn't wait. Kind of like premature ejaculation.
Not a bad analogy. I guess that's possible. But for him, it's not just the kill that he's after, it's the whole process. The interplay with the victim, the power he exhibits over her while he tortures her. He skips parts of his ritual. It won't be nearly as enjoyable for him.
Makes sense to me, Curtis said, but that still leaves us with the question of why he rushed through it.
Could be something as simple as he had no place to bring the body, Vail said. Where he could take his time. He's been in prison, and he's on the run.
And he doesn't know how long he'll be out, Johnson said. How long he'll be free, so he's doing his best to get in as much fun as he can.
Yeah, he takes less time with the body, enjoys it a little less, but he'll make it up in volume.
Vail filled her lungs with frigid, moist air. She exhaled and sent a robust cloud of vapor into the forest.
Hope you're wrong, Leslie, because that would really suck.
Hurdle left shortly thereafter, but Vail, Curtis, and Johnson remained at the crime scene another 90 minutes, passing theories back and forth. They decided that until they knew more about Tammy Hartwell, who she was, where she frequented, what could have brought her into the crosshairs of Roscoe Lee Marks, they were playing with a deck of cards missing all the suits. You didn't get very far, and the game was not much fun. Hurdle had excused Vail and Curtis from returning to the command post until the morning. Given their past experience with and knowledge of Marks, their time was better spent working the new homicide, for the moment. When he got the call about the Hartwell murder, he had directed Tarkov to hand out assignments to the task force members. They could deal with the fugitive 101 items that they had discussed before they broke for dinner. And if there were things they needed help with, he could pull more men and women from the marshal service as well as the county police force. When Vail walked into her house at midnight, she found Richard Prati sharing a glass of port with Robbie in the family room. Jonathan had driven Ryan home, then gone on to his dorm because he had an 8 a.m. class.
You two still at it?
Robbie sat up and drained his glass.
We were swapping stories about growing up in Los Angeles.
Vail wondered if he had disclosed some of the most significant ones, those he had told Vail a few years ago. His face was impassive and she could not read it. A rarity.
We had some similar experiences, Prati said. Why we got into law enforcement.
Vail picked up a pillow from the couch and fluffed it, put it back in the right place.
I'm glad you two connected. It's good to have those kinds of relationships where you work.
God knows it took me a while to find them.
We've got each other's backs, figuratively, Prati laughed. I've got a good gig doing what I do. Something opens up in my unit, he shrugged. We'll see. Robbie may be interested.
Vail studied him intently, but his expression did not reveal anything.
If you had to do it over again, Richard, would you leave ATF for DEA?
I've been lucky to have spent time with two law enforcement agencies I admire and respect. I cherish my years at ATF, and I wouldn't trade my work with DEA for anything. So, tough decision. But, yeah, I'd do it again.
Robbie pushed himself off the couch.
I've got to get up early. He gave Prati a man hug. We'll have to do this again. Hopefully, a time when your wife can join us, and Karen won't get called away. He glanced at Vail. Miracles have been known to happen.
Vail grinned and clenched her teeth.
I love you, honey.
Maybe catch a Nats game next season, Prati said. A buddy of mine has season tickets.
Vail gave Prati a hug and backed away.
great seeing you again, even if it was only a short visit. She had washed her face and pulled off her clothes when she heard the front door close. After she fell into bed, Hershey climbed in beside her and cuddled up against her body. Off in the distance, she heard Robbie talking to her, but that was the last thing that registered as she fell into a deep sleep. Chapter 17. What do I do about the book tour? Jasmine and Vale were sitting in a McLean, Virginia Starbucks. Vale had pulled the lid off her venti Americano and was stirring in a packet of raw sugar. The snow had stopped during the night, but the cold temperatures persisted. The cafe was warm and cozy, the inside of its windows dripping with condensation. That's going to have to be put on hold. I just don't see a way around it. If I can't promote my book, I might be in breach of my contract. My publisher will be very happy with the press and media attention. They'll do fine. In a way, this is the best possible thing that could have happened for them. Jasmine stared out the window, wrapping her hands around the coffee to warm them. We'll see. If I'd known this was going to happen. Vale took a bite of her egg sandwich as she waited for Jasmine to finish. You're going to say you never would have written the book?
Hell no. It was cathartic in more ways than one.
She glanced around the cafe and lowered her voice.
It wasn't something I planned to do. It just sort of happened when I began reflecting on everything. How I'd lived with a man who had brutally murdered young women and men. How that man had kissed me and held me when I was afraid. The most important man in my life.
Jasmine started peeling away the corner of the cardboard cup jacket.
That's how I came to write the book. Started with some thoughts, kept writing night after night after night. I realized I probably saved some lives by turning him in. Eventually, the guilt subsided, but it's never completely gone away. And now he's out and killing again because of me.
Look, Vale said, no one could have foreseen your father's escape. Well, I guess he did. He's likely been planning it for a while, but there's no way you could have known what was going to happen when you wrote your book. I'm sure your publisher will understand that your safety has to be the top priority.
My agent is talking to them today.
Hopefully we'll catch him fast and it won't be an issue. She snapped her lid back on the cup.
Speaking of which, is there anything you can tell us that would be helpful?
Like what? Like his bank. Is his checking account still open? Jasmine laughed sardonically.
Like a dutiful daughter, maybe out of guilt, I've made sure it stayed open. Every so often I make a small deposit to generate some activity so they don't close it. Kind of stupid, isn't it? I mean, he's in prison for life.
She shook her head.
Definitely guilt.
I'm not judging you. Whatever the reason you did it, it's a good thing. That'll help us. But stop for now. We need to monitor it for activity.
Okay. Which bank? Sutter Savings. I'll text you the account number.
She took out her phone and opened the messaging app.
What else do you need?
Those friends of your father, the ones you told me about, anything more you can give me on them? Places he used to go when he wanted to unwind? A bar, a restaurant, anything you can think of? Jasmine took a bite of her blueberry scone and chewed as she thought.
He did go out drinking, but I never knew where. It's not like he accounted for his whereabouts to me or to my mom.
What was their relationship like? Jasmine's gaze wandered around the cafe, pondering the question.
It's hard. I keep trying to think about signs, things I saw and how they interacted that could have tipped me off to the fact that he was murdering people.
She shook her head.
Their relationship was fine, I guess. They spent time together. Sometimes they fought, sometimes they didn't. He never hit her, at least not that I ever saw.
She looked down at the table, no doubt replaying her childhood in her mind's eye.
they weren't very demonstrative.
Demonstrative?
Jasmine shrugged. They didn't hold hands in public. I never saw them kissing. It's almost like they were more friends than lovers.
She stopped talking, then took a bite of her scone.
Some couples are like that, Vale said. I wouldn't read too much into it.
But it could definitely be significant.
Do you think it's possible he's gay?
What?
Jasmine began rolling the edge of the cardboard jacket between her thumb and index finger.
Why would you ask that?
Just something we're looking into. Vale watched her a second, sensing there might be more to it than she was letting on. Now did not seem like the time to press it.
You going to tell me where you're staying?
She hesitated a moment.
I think it's best that no one knows, for now.
Vale nodded slowly. Okay, I'll respect that, for now. She drained her cup and dabbed her mouth with the napkin.
But I want you to promise me you'll stay in touch. I text you, I want you to answer me right away. I could have something important to tell you for your safety, and I need to know you're getting my message. If I call, answer it.
Got it.
Vale frowned. I still don't like it. Who knows where your father is? You have habits you're not conscious of, things that he knows you do, places you go and have gone.
I'm doing my best to be aware of things like that. She placed a hand on Vale's.
I'll be okay, Karen. I may not be trained in this kind of thing, but I've got my intuition, and so far it's served me well.
You've done okay. Lucky?
Nope, just being smart about things. Really, I'm going to be fine.
Vale crumpled up the wrapper and dumped her empty cup in the recycling bin behind her.
I have to get back. They stood up and Vale gave Jasmine a hug.
I'll be in touch. Be careful.
Jasmine grinned weakly.
Always. Especially now.
Chapter 18. Marks awoke with a start. He had fallen asleep a short time after preparing his bed, which, when he settled into it, was more comfortable than he thought it might be when he gathered up the sundry materials. Then again, he had been sleeping on prison cots that dated back 5 or 6 decades. Anything better than that would feel like duck feathers. He sat up, taking in his environment. He was in the barn, and light was streaming in through cracks and spaces between the wood slats that formed the walls. And there it was again, the creak of rusted hinges. It's what had jostled him from a deep sleep, deeper than any he'd had since his arrest. Definitely not his intention when he put his head down last night. He did not have a watch, but it looked to be late morning. He thought for sure he would be up at dawn, his routine at Potter. Now, free, without the regimen of a highly structured schedule, he should have realized that his body might react differently. And right now, it had apparently let him down. He relaxed, his normally razor-sharp senses going on vacation. He would not let that happen again. Marks glanced across the barn at the entrance, which was located to the right of an extensive tool rack. A man, silhouetted against the gray light, stood in the doorway.
Hey, who are you? Mark stood up. I needed a place to sleep. It was snowing. I was cold.
The man squinted, clearly trying to make sense of what was happening. Did he have a squatter? Was this going to be a problem? Or could he merely ask his house guest to leave?
What's your name? Mark asked.
William. What's yours?
Bart. William appeared to be a bit over 70, in decent shape, but probably no more than 150 pounds. Not much of a challenge for a violent criminal with multiple murders under his belt and 7 years of hard time in a max security prison to his name.
You have to go, William said. I'm leaving. No worries.
But Marks knew that he could not trust William to keep quiet about his presence, especially when there had to be police reports detailing the brazen, bloody escape of a convict from Potter yesterday. Not just a convict, a convicted murderer. William tilted his head, and in doing so, his eyes caught the light. Mark saw something there. Perhaps recognition? Perhaps not. But he could not take the chance. As William stood there, pondering the situation, Marks knew what had to happen. And if William could put two and two together, he would know it too. But William looked like a simple man, and he probably believed that if he talked tough, he would dodge a bullet, and his unwelcome guest would be on his way. Marks held his hands up in surrender and walked toward the exit, which happened to be past William. Before William realized what was happening, he was immobilized in a headlock, Mark's left arm cutting off the blood supply to his brain, and Mark's right hand clamping over the man's mouth, preventing an errant noise or desperate scream. William slumped into Mark's hold, unconscious. Mark's set him on the ground and perused the workbench, ultimately finding his tool of choice, a wicked-looking keyhole saw, long and narrow, with alternating teeth that were sharp as a knife. It was as imposing as it was lethal. Marks jabbed it into William's chest between the fourth and fifth ribs, slightly left of center. "No witnesses, Willie," Marks said. "Just the way it's gotta be." He then yanked out the saw and brought the man to his feet, bent his knees, and folded William over his shoulder. With a quick contraction of his thighs, he lifted William and took him for a ride. No one was going to find William's body parts for an awfully long time. Chapter 19. Vale walked into the command center at 1 p.m. and found Hurdle hunched over his keyboard examining spreadsheet data. Tarkov was seated across from him studying other documents.
"Long breakfast?" Hurdle said without diverting his eyes.
"We had a good talk. She's worried about not being able to finish her book tour."
"I expect to get Marks sooner rather than later, but either way, her sales and promotion are not my problem."
Vale sat down opposite him. "Of course. I think she understood that my sole concern was keeping her safe and apprehending her father."
"What about the bank account?" Hurdle asked.
"She's kept it open, and when I hit her with the question of whether or not her father's gay, she seemed, I don't know, like there was something there. Guess I could have been reading into it." The door swung out and Curtis stepped into the RV.
"Just got a call from Warden Barfield at Potter. Wants to know if we're making any progress on the escape."
Tarkov swiveled in his direction.
"And you told him?"
"That we've got guys working on it."
"He accepted that?"
"He wanted details, but I didn't want to give him anything," Curtis said. "Until we know who's working with Marks, we can't trust anyone there. Not saying the warden's a suspect, but he's a suspect. Know what I mean?"
Hurdle shrugged. "Can't think of a case where a warden helped an inmate escape, not counting incompetence. But there's always a first. You two gonna follow up on his three friends the daughter gave us?"
"Next on our list," Curtis said. "Good to know."
"For now, that's your priority."
"Well, that and investigating the Hartwell murder," Vale said as she got up from her seat. "You want us to check back here later?"
"I'll let you know. If not, see both of you tomorrow morning."
Vale and Curtis left the trailer, Vale offering to drive.
"Where are we on the three of them?"
"Johnson did some of the grunt work, looked into their whereabouts, and put together some solid dossiers. She did a nice job."
"I would have told you if she was going to be a problem. Leslie's a good cop. She'll have your back."
Vale turned right onto Lincolnia Road.
"Where to?"
"Hood Bridge."
"What bridge?"
Curtis laughed.
"Woodbridge, in Prince William County. What we call it, you know?" Because it's got some high crime areas?
Hey, I didn't coin the phrase. Fair or not, I wasn't surprised this joker lives there.
Which one?
We've only got a 20 on Vincent Stuckey. Johnson's still working on Scott McFarlane and Booker Gaines, the one Jasmine said was following her in the store.
You got a phone number for Stuckey?
Curtis squinted, then pulled out his cell and thumbed through his emails.
Yeah, you thinking of calling him?
Just want to make sure he's there. Don't want to make a wasted trip. He read off the number and she dialed her Samsung. It rang 3 times before a male voice picked up the line.
This is UPS and we've got a package for Vincent Stuckey. Is Mr. Stuckey available?
Yeah, that's me, but why are you calling? Don't you guys just show up?
This is our 3rd attempt, Vale said, and it's marked for signature. Our driver can't leave it at the door. You going to be around a while so I can get you your package?
Be home for another hour, then I gotta take off.
Who's it from?
Sorry, sir. I only have the tracking information. Would you like the number?
No, just get here in the next hour.
Vale hung up, a grin thinning her lips. He's there. They arrived at Dale City Apartments, a series of attached 4-story red brick buildings with thick trunked oak trees that lined the periphery. Curtis had briefed her on the drive over, filling her in on the backgrounder that Johnson had assembled. Vale parked at the curb and leaned forward, her eyes surveying the complex.
You're thinking he'll run if he sees us coming?
Vale sat back and faced Curtis. If he's involved with Mark's escape, yeah, there's a risk.
You got a UPS box in the trunk?
Funny. Vale popped open her door. Let's split up. Take a quick look around, see how many ways in and out there are. A place this size gotta be a few. Vale made her way around the building exterior, then headed inside and found a map of the property. There were several exits, but based on Stuckey's apartment number, they would be able to approach his place with exposure to only one. She called Curtis and told him what she had learned, and a couple of minutes later he met her on the 4th floor, down the hall from Stuckey's door.
Only way out is off the terrace, right into the pool. He jumps. I'm not sure we'll have enough time to get down there and fish him out.
Not a problem. We can handle it.
With the task force, Vale said, manpower isn't an issue. We can have a couple of guys here in 20 minutes.
Curtis checked his watch. He's here now. I'm not interested in waiting. He goes off the balcony, I'll go after him. You can run around the building.
With the temperature hovering around 35 degrees, Vale could not find fault with that division of tasks.
Works for me.
They walked up to the door and Curtis drew back his coat. Placing a hand on his Sig Sauer, he used Vale to shield Stuckey's view. She knocked and focused her attention on listening for unusual noises emanating from the apartment. Seconds later, she heard the footsteps of someone approaching. There was no peephole lens.
Who is it? UPS?
Karen from next door? I think I found something of yours in the hall.
What kind of something?
A wallet with like $200 in it. It was right outside your apartment. Gotta be yours. I was thinking maybe you can spot me a 20 for turning it in.
The knob rattled and the door pulled open. Stuckey made eye contact with Vale and then bent left to get a view of Curtis. But Vale shifted right, catching Stuckey's gaze.
I didn't really find a wallet, Vincent. I'm FBI. Can we talk?
He looked past her, taking in the hallway.
He's thinking about running.
We've got 7 agents outside in case you plan to jump off your balcony, and it's really frigging cold outside, so that pool water's gonna go right down to your bones. So how about we just sit and chat for a few minutes, and then we'll be out of your hair. Promise.
Stuckey chewed his lip a second.
There ain't no wallet?
Vale blinked.
He's not smiling. That wasn't a joke. No wallet. Sorry.
What's this about, then?
Roscoe Lee Marks.
What about him?
How about we go inside? Curtis asked.
Yeah, all right.
Stucky turned and led them to a tattered couch, its cushions flattened and potholed with wear, its threadbare olive-green material pocked with stains.
Okay? Gross. Do I really want to sit down on that?
Stucky sank into a nearby chair. Vale took the armrest of the sofa, as safe as she could get. Curtis floated in the background, casually glancing at items in the apartment, which was decorated much like the couch, thrift store reject.
We know you're friends with Roscoe, Vale said. Since we were kids. What about it?
He contact you in the past couple of days? Stucky looked away.
No.
That was a trick question, Vincent. Vale waited for him to bring his eyes back to hers.
We know he called you.
Okay, that's a lie, but it usually works.
So
we want to know what he said. Where's he staying?
Didn't tell me. I told him he could crash here, but he didn't think that'd be a good idea.
No shit. Marx is a smart cookie. Stucky, apparently, didn't get any of the chocolate chips when they were mixing the batter.
And?
Where's he staying? Where's he been?
Stucky looked away again, his eyes examining the puke-green shag carpet.
Vincent, look at me. Vale tilted her head and gave him a one-sided grin when he brought his gaze back to hers.
It's against the law to impede our investigation.
See, your buddy's been killing people again, and if you know where he is and you're not telling us, you could be an accessory to those murders. Do you understand what that means?
I think so.
It would not be good. She paused, realized she had better elaborate.
You could go to prison. For a long time.
A guy like Roscoe can survive in a place like that, but you, she shrugged.
Be better if you just cooperate so you don't have to worry about that.
Stucky thought a moment, his gaze wandering across Vale's face.
He wouldn't tell me where he is. He's moving around. That's all I know. Not staying in one place. Wanted me to bring him money.
And? Did you?
Ain't got any to give. As it is, I'm behind 2 months in my rent. I have a hard time keeping jobs.
What about places he liked to go before he was arrested?
Any place they served beer. Stucky laughed, showing tobacco yellow teeth.
You're not being very helpful, Vincent. I need specifics.
The smile disappeared. Couple of bars he liked in town. Don't remember which ones.
Vale nodded. What about when you were kids? Did you like to go places? Places you used to play? Where you'd go to get away from things? From your parents?
Stucky started biting his bottom lip. He got up from the chair and turned, came face to face with Curtis.
What's wrong? Vale asked. Something bothering you about a place you used to go when you were kids?
Teens? Somewhere you weren't supposed to go?
No, Stucky stammered.
Nothing like that. He started rubbing his left forearm. We're on to something here.
She glanced at Curtis, and he appeared to be thinking the same thing.
Tell me about what happened when you were younger. I want to know all the details.
I'm not supposed to talk about it. Vale pushed off the sofa and put her left hand on Stucky's shoulder.
Come on, sit back down. I promise we won't say anything to anyone about what happened. You have my word.
Something's not right with this guy. He's not just lower IQ. There's something else.
Stucky sank back into his chair. Vale knelt in front of him.
Something happened with you and Roscoe?
And Scott and Booker and Lance.
Vale and Curtis shared a look. Scott McFarlane and Booker Gaines, right? She got a nod from Stucky, so she pressed on.
Who's Lance?
Lance is the one who started it, but Rocky's the one who took the blame. Well, Rocky did kill the kid.
Back up a minute, Curtis said. Who's Rocky?
Roscoe. That was our name for him, because he was so strong, you know, like a rock.
And Lance's last name? Vale asked.
Can't remember. We used to hang out all the time, but I never saw him again after that. Something with a K? Kinda like that old film. Kodak. But not Kodak.
You said there was a kid involved that Rocky killed?
That's the part I'm not supposed to talk about.
I understand, Vale said, and we won't tell anyone. Your secret's safe with us, okay?
Stucky looked down.
I guess.
He took a breath, then looked up and his eyes found the clock on the wall.
I gotta go. I have an appointment.
We'll be done here very soon, Vale said. Tell us about this kid Rocky killed, and we'll be on our way.
He licked his lips and canted his head toward his hands.
Name was Eddie. He was just a kid who hung out at the playground, talked shit, smoked reefer. I don't think he went to our school.
How old were you? Curtis asked.
14.
And what happened?
We'd been smoking. Rocky got us some angel dust and we was real wasted. Eddie came by and...
He shook his head, as if he had some water trapped in his ear. He slapped his forehead a few times.
And he had a gun and Rocky took it from him and shot him. And me.
Vale recoiled.
Why?
Stucky looked up at her.
I don't fucking know. We was high. Rocky had a temper, even back then. Maybe Eddie was talking shit again, but whatever. It happened real fast. After the gunshots, I didn't hear or see nothing.
Where'd you get shot? Curtis asked.
Stucky pulled back a lock of hair and revealed a dime-shaped scar overlying his temple.
That might explain Stucky, but...
And Eddie? He died?
Stucky nodded, his gaze again somewhere on the floor. Vale ran a hand across her mouth.
What about the police?
Well, Scott told me him and Booker and Rocky left. The cops came and found me there, took me to the hospital. Next thing I know, when I woke up after they did surgery and I got out of the hospital, they found Rocky and arrested him.
How come I don't know about this? It's not in his file. Unless...
But Rocky didn't do time, Curtis said. In prison, did he? Booker was the only witness who remembered what happened, and he said it was Eddie's fault. Eddie came at him and pulled the gun on us, and Rocky was trying to get it from him, and it went off.
Is that what happened?
That's what Booker said. That's all that mattered.
But didn't you just say,
I don't remember!
He slapped a hand against the chair arm.
The bullet, it made a hole in my brain.
His face was red and he had started to perspire.
Okay, Vincent, it's all right. I understand.
Vale stood up and pulled out a card from her pocket. If Rocky calls you, I want you to let me know right away. I really don't want to have to arrest you and put you in jail. And don't mention we came to visit you because you'll never hear from him again. Can you do that?
But that'd be like telling on him. And Rocky's my friend.
Look, Vincent, Vale gathered her thoughts. Rocky did some bad things. He killed a lot of innocent people, men and women who were just living their lives. And he's doing it again. I know he's your friend, but he's a dangerous guy. It's our job to keep him from hurting more people. You can help us do that. That'd be best for everybody.
You help us out, Curtis said as he came around to Vale's side. You'd be a hero.
That's not his motivator.
I can even see about getting you some reward money.
She pulled out her wallet, removed a 20, and offered it to Stucky. He snatched it with the alacrity of a cheetah.
Okay?
Stucky nodded sheepishly.
Yeah, okay.
As they pulled away from the curb, Curtis looked back at the apartment building.
You think he'll call us?
More relevant question is whether Marks will call him again. She was silent a minute, then said,
poor guy.
Drugs, guns, and stupidity are a bad mix.
We've got to find that juvie case. It's obviously sealed. There was nothing like that in Underwood's file or in yours.
Nope.
Curtis looked out at the passing snow-covered foliage. Think it went down like Vincent said?
Knowing our buddy Marks? No. He probably killed the kid. No struggle necessary. But who knows? Maybe it was just a dumb fight between two kids who were high.
Either way, probably doesn't matter. Vale tilted her head. Actually, it does, because now we've got another friend of theirs to follow up on, this Lance Joker.
Vincent said he never saw him again after that.
Vincent didn't see him again. Doesn't mean Marks didn't. Chapter 20. Curtis hung up his phone. That was the sergeant in charge of the records room. It's a bit of a quagmire.
How so?
Vale negotiated a turn onto Chainbridge Road, then slowed behind a line of cars. The temperature had dropped and snow had begun falling again. Fairfax County used to be on an old CAD, computer-aided dispatch system. Back in 97 or 98, we brought in Northrop Grumman and migrated over to new records management software. Idea was to go to a paperless reporting system. Problem was, the integration was a massive data dump. All sorts of shit happened. Records got, well, not lost per se, but misplaced.
Well, not really misplaced. They weren't compatible with the new system, so they didn't transfer over.
So, does this Marks file still exist, or are we wasting our time?
It won't show up in the new CAD system, but the original paper reports were archived. Too expensive to digitize all the incompatible records because there are thousands of them. So, generally speaking, when we access the database, it's as if these files don't exist.
So, if you don't know what you're looking for, you have no idea.